were no filament, is there any possible way that something crazy with the wiring, that under load, the filament voltage was no longer getting to the 866s? And by the way, did the power supply, when under load, fade in a fraction of a second, or did it take 10 seconds to fade? Over to you, Mel.
I got to stretch my memory. I've never seen 866s. I've never really used them, really. Like I said, when I got down anything under 1,000 volts, I went to 5 R4s. Now, the filaments didn't go out. You can see the filaments were still lit inside the 866s. I checked that. I remember checking the filament. Now, how did I check it? I put a light bulb across it, basically, you know, to see that a lot of my testing was done with light bulbs, believe it or not. Light bulbs in series and you name it, all kinds of ideas I had. But the 866s, I wouldn't say they went completely dead, but, you know, they didn't have that nice, clean, blue glow that initially that they had. They went way down. And in other words, maybe if I looked in a dark room, I still would have seen some glow in them over.
Now, the way you had to phase the secondary windings to make sure all the voltages of the three secondary windings added, how did you know when you had the secondary windings properly phased, Mel? Go ahead.
My half-baked VOM, I said, set up here with lots of resistors on there and everything, and I knew that I would, the way I had it set up at zero, at when it, the meter went to full scale, that was with my one resistor set up, I knew that was 100 volts, and I just kept adding resistors, multiplying, you know, what that resistance it took to get to 100, and I finally got to, you know, then had my tap for 1,000 volts, and then my 2,000 volt tap, and so on and so forth, with all these resistors laid out, this humongous amount of resistors and things laid out on a big piece of wood. I mean, with thong stock clips, you know what that looked like. That's how I basically, you know what I did? I used a, well, how was I going to get DC to this setup? So what I used to do to measure DC, AC with a DC setup like that, I had this copper oxide rectifier. This long one is about 10 inches long. I don't know if you know about that, Dick. Over.
Okay. You could have used a voltage divider network of resistors, bringing it down to, let me pick a number, 10 volts AC, going into your simple rectifier, which goes into your 1 milliamp meter. You could have done it that way. Or did you try to rectify the raw 2,000 volts AC with a great big long string copper oxide rectifier, and then put that through the resistor network into your meter? Is that what you did, Mel? Go ahead.
Yes, that's the way I did it. In fact, that was a standard practice to use those copper oxide rectifiers in that type of setup. They were they had high voltage instruments that were based on that principle, Dick. Over.
Now, the capacitive coupling between these windings is such that if one of the windings of one of the transformers was bucking out of phase, under extremely light loading, you could still get enough high voltage to charge up the supply, although with the bleeder resistor, I'm having trouble. Did your bleeder resistor, before you loaded it, did it seem to give off the right amount of heat and current? What did you use as a bleeder resistor on the 2,000 volt DC supply, Mel? Go ahead.
I don't remember what I wound up. I computed it out, and also because I was a big resistor. I guess it was at least 50 watt resistor at the time, you know, big old wire wound resistor. And it was just so-called your safety factor you used to put across that. Supposedly, it was really there to discharge the supply, you know, when power was removed for safety. I mean, it was a standard design of those days. And, I made sure that when I added the second transformer, I could see the voltage double on my so-called meter setup. So I added the third, you know, I had to switch the winding back once or twice as I added to make sure I got the right phasing of it so that they added. But I saw it add. I mean, I saw it go up sufficiently 3 times. That I remember doing. I was smart enough to know that at the time. Over.
Have you... Both you and Joe have got quite a mystery here. on what's going on. Joe's going to have to divide and conquer, measure individual windings, what's the AC voltage under load, individual DC voltage under load, individual voltage drop across the choke if there is one, under load. You're going to have to look at each one of the components under load and find out. I mean, this pair of power supplies, Joe, must obey Kirchhoff's voltage laws. That is to say, all the voltage in a loop must add up to zero when you go all the way around the loop. And you've got a bunch of series components here in these two series power supplies, and you're just going to have to go down and measure each one of those components to find out who's eating your lunch. That's about the only suggestion I've got here. I know we didn't give you a nice, clean answer, Joe. W-H-O-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W, in the SecNet. Want
to know what the teacher said?
I'm going to ask Joe first, then I'm going to come back to you. I'm afraid of what he said. Go ahead, Joe.
Well, I've been listening for the past 20 minutes talking about Mel's house boy problem, and it's good to see somebody else has the same kind of problem or similar. And I would like to hear the answer, Mel, of what the teacher said, because it's got me kind of curious after listening for 20-something minutes. Go ahead. What's the answer?
Okay. Ready for this, Dick?
Boy, are we ready. We're on the edge of our seat, Mel.
Well, I'll never forget. His name was Mr. Rose. Very, very nice man. And he was on in age at the time, because I remember he retired not long after that, and he had been an electrical engineer and then for many years, and worked for, I believe he told me, I think it was Westinghouse. And what happened was that, during the Depression, couldn't get a job anymore, so he became a school teacher at Brooklyn Tech. And I posed the problem to him and everything like that, and he says, you are getting the auto transformer effect. Now, it is true that a auto transformer can either boost or buck. Am I correct, Dick? Over.
Absolutely. Go ahead.
Okay. So now, using that as a criteria that you're getting an auto transformer effect, I would always believe that the auto transformer was based on, but I understand that there are auto transformers. I always looked at them, you know, as a three-wire device that you saw many places. They put on the line to raise the line or to lower the line to, you know, appropriate voltages. Most of the places was used because the line voltage was low. But I understand that there are auto transformers that had multi-taps on them, and that you can make different arrangements. Am I correct? Over.
There are kinds of transformers where the primary has got a 105, a 110, a 115, a 120, and a 125 volt tap for where you put the 115 volts in. And the secondary on some transformers have got the taps. They got a center tap, and then the outer high voltage windings have multiple taps. And in theory, you can combine the primary and the secondary. However, you cannot combine the primary and secondary as an auto transformer when you're doing this particular experiment of yours. No way in hell. I'm presuming that your great big tan-colored mil-spec rated transformer had a thoroughly floating secondary winding compared to the primary, even if there are multiple taps on the secondary winding and multiple taps on the primary winding. I'm presuming primary and secondary were thoroughly independent windings. Is that true, Mel?
Of course, that's why I questioned this auto transformer. I'm not talking about a transformer with a primary that had, like you say, that many transformers had either, you know, taps that you can take a 110 transformer and rewire it, you know, or have two primaries that you can put them in series, and, you know, and go to 220 or things like that, or transformers that have to go with different taps, say that you could go, say, from one that 110 or 120, you know, a so-called common and then a number of taps. I'm talking about a classic design of an auto transformer that in most cases I saw had only three wires, single winding, single winding with three wires. I'm talking about that type of transformer, Dick. Over.
Yeah, you certainly were not using that, so that doesn't sound like an appropriate explanation for your phenomenon.
Exactly. I tried to pursue Howard, but I was afraid to go in much further than he most likely would. May have got perturbed or something. But that's the only answer I ever received, that I'm getting an auto-transformer type of effect. And that is why it is, that's why when you put an auto-transformer into a system, that when you load it down, if the auto-transformer is not set correctly, you will see a drop, a sufficient drop. Now, I have used auto-transformers, and I have never experienced that, because I, you know, we had a lot of brownout problems here years ago in Brooklyn, and if you had an air conditioner, the 220 air conditioner with the imbalance and the two lines and everything, you measure from neutral to one line, you get, say, 110 volts, you measure to the other one, you see 110 volts, you go across the two of them, you should see 220, you know what you saw? 190. So what did you do? You put an auto transformer, correct? Over.
Yeah, there are portions of New York City which are wired on three-phase and therefore very different than Nassau and Suffolk County. There are portions of Staten Island, for instance, where the two phases give you a voltage that adds by square root of 3, not by the 2-to-1 ratio, if you know what I mean, because of the phase difference between the two phases. Is it possible you've got that kind of wiring in your house, Mel?
May I try? No, just a single phase here. We got three wires coming up the backyard here, neutral and 2 110. And, well, I'm not talking about here. I think Edison has more or less corrected that problem, but I'm going back some years ago when you bought it an air conditioner and the compressor, you know, you went to put it on during a hot summer, you heard it go, make that hum. Because the compressor couldn't start with the head pressure, because of the lower line voltage. And what that was, they used to sell a transformer that was in a box that had an AC cord coming out of it that you put back into the wall, and a receptacle which you plugged your air conditioner back in, and that corrected the problem. And I looked at the number of those transformers I had around, and it was just three wires, over.
Understand. W-H-U-S-A-Y. K-2-L-I-W. Hey, Doug, we haven't heard from you in a long time. We're going to wait long enough for you to get an edge in word-wise. Go right ahead, Doug.
Okay, I'll see if I can get a word in edge-wise. I didn't really realize that the filament repeater was duplex. Found out about that tonight. I decided to take a look. So apparently it is, at least tonight. And I can obviously talk to the fellow repeater. I am going to address the first place when I signed in. We had a problem about a guy named Bose. And it seemed to me that I had realized that he was really one of the earlier guys that had done this. Anyway, getting back to the fellow with the power supply problem, let me drop it for a second. Okay, the first fellow with the power supply problem, I don't know anything about the second problem, the second fellow, but the first problem, I have the first fellow's problem. He's talking about a transformers with two secondary windings, I believe, or maybe a tap secondary winding. I don't understand that, so I need to get back and find out about that. But so the question is, are the two secondary windings feeding separate bridge rectifiers, which are then tied together in series, or are the two secondary windings tied in series, and the whole combination feeding the bridge rectifier? And if that's the case, is the bridge rectifier a bridge where the common place of the rectifiers are tied to ground, and the common cathodes are tied to the outfit, to the output, or for one situation. In other words, there may be some kind of a miswire there. Or, if these are solid-state rectifiers, there may be a bad diode. So back to you, Dick. K2RIW in the second, WA2SAY.
Quite good, Doug. Your audio is a bit low, but you're coming through the Selden machine quite well, and yes, it is linked to the 8.5 machine. They get linked together during the TechNet as well as other times. And what Joe was describing to us is a completely separate pair of power supplies of 400-volt category each. Each one has its own secondary winding of a transformer going into its own bridge rectifier, going into its own filter network, and the output of those two DC voltages from the two separate power supplies floating by way of their secondary windings of their transformers, they were connected in series. And his problem was that when he puts that combined series DC wired power supply combination under load, that one of them drops around 160 volts and the other one drops only 50 volts. So there's a huge disparity there as to the way the power supplies act individually. If I understand them correctly, individually he can load the power supplies, they act normally. Put them in series, and they act in this crazy way. And so, while he's got them in series, first of all, he's got to reconfirm, if he didn't already say so, that when he loads each individual one, that they behave correctly. That when he puts each one under the same full load, maybe it's 150 milliamps, we'll say, that they behave correctly individually. Then when he puts them together and they behave in this crazy way, by way of Kirchhoff's laws, he's going to have to measure, let me drop. He's going to have to measure the individual voltage drops of each of the individual components, because by Kirchhoff's laws, the voltages must add. You've got to be a little bit careful here about one thing, and that is when you're measuring DC voltage with a floating digital voltmeter or volt-ohm milliammeter, you'll get one set of voltages. If you're measuring the ripple voltage that might be present, you've got to take that into account. I mean, if this is the best of all worlds, you would have a completely floating oscilloscope measuring each individual power supply under load. But, of course, that's kind of hard to do, to put high voltages like this into an oscilloscope. There's ways of doing it with dual probes and whatever and combining, but that gets a little complicated. So by way of Kirchhoff's virtual voltage laws, the voltages around the loop of the two series supplies must add. And so he's going to have to go component by component and find out on his schematic diagram of the composite network what does or doesn't add. So we're going to have to give Joe a homework assignment to make all those measurements and come back and tell us all this. Let me turn it over to Joe so he can make sure I didn't misunderstand him there. W2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, when I measure this transmitter power supply, I operate the relay manually. Actually, I operate it with the transmitter disconnected, so the power supply had no load on it whatsoever. Both power supplies, the working one and the non-working one, unloaded, give me virtually the same DC voltages out, unloaded, okay? The bad one drops down from, say, normally get 660 available to the transmitter on a good working supply. On the good working supply, it's about 590 to 585 on the bad power supply.
Okay. Before you told me 440 down to 360 down to 280 on one supply, you told me 353 down to 305 on the other. Well, those are the DC voltages. You didn't say what kind of voltage you're measuring now, but you're giving me, I guess those are the AC voltages going into the bridge, but you didn't say. There's a lot of ambiguity here, Joe. Go ahead.
I don't know why they should be. The only voltages I told you I measured VAC was the VAC coming out of both windings only dropped down by 15 volts. So if I have two supplies and one is bad and one is good, and the transformers both behave the same way, it tells me they seem like they're drawing similar amounts of current, and the drop is similar on both windings of both power supplies. So that makes a transformer probably not to be the culprit. Would you agree?
Sure do, Joe. And then from the DC voltage point out of the bridge rectifier to the final DC voltage out of each filter network of each power supply, what was that voltage drop on the bad one versus the good one? Go ahead.
Kilo Delta 2, Bravo Delta, what a thought on this?
Reverse the power supplies.
Joe, go ahead with that particular answer, and then the BD will pick you up in a minute. Go ahead, Joe.
Say why, try to cut in there from the internet. You stepped on him.
Signal, Doug, but you could use a hell of a lot more audio. Doug's question is, I'm pretty sure he's got two completely separate bridge rectifiers on each individual secondary transformer winding, and then two completely separate filter networks, and the DC output of those filter networks are what's in series. One of the first measurements I'd want to make, Joe, where you've already confirmed the voltage, AC voltage, out of each transformer is approximately correct, no load, full load. The next thing is now to go from the DC voltage out of the bridge rectifier to the DC voltage out of the filter network. That voltage drop on each power supply with a floating voltmeter, I think you should measure. That's the only thing that's left in the loop, so to speak, that could be violating Kirchhoff's law, assuming now that you're getting the right DC voltage to ground out of each bridge rectifier. So each bridge rectifier to ground, are you getting the right DC voltage to its local ground, and also the voltage drop across the filter networks. WA2RYY, K2RYW.
I don't have the answer to that because I was checking the resultant output from the DC supplies, not actually off the DC, the rectified DC voltage out of off the bridge of the bad supply. No, I didn't check it back that far, but I did go back and check the resistance, the DC resistance of the choke on both supplies, and they are very similar as far as what they read, because I thought maybe I had an open choke or something with a high internal DC resistance, and they seem to be approximately the same, but I guess I'm going to have to do it point by point and see what dropping. And I don't think the choke is doing, because the choke is a pretty huge chunk of iron in these things. In fact, one choke, I believe, these are big ones. One choke is rated for 5 Henry, and the other is rated for 3 Henry. See, the 5 Henry is a 0.3 amp DC, 80 ohms resistance. And it was a 3 Henry choke, 0.4 amp DC, 30 ohms DC resistance. So, and the DC resistances do come out to be pretty close to what they say. say 80 is like 75, so they were within like 5 ohms of what the rating and the paperwork said. So yeah, I guess I will have to check this thing point by point by point, do a little bit of homework on the thing, and then come back next week. Maybe I'll have the answer for you, maybe not. And I have a comment about another subject we talked about 2 weeks ago. Would you like to hear the comment?
Yeah, before we change subjects, Bravo Delta, W2, or something, number 2, Bravo Delta had a comment. Give us your full call and your name, sir, and your comment. Go right ahead.
Good evening, Dick, and everyone on the net. K2RW from Kilo Delta 2, Bravo Delta. Just a suggestion for Joe. I would put a diode across each power supply, a diode configured such that it is reverse biased under normal conditions. So on one power supply, or on each power supply, I would put the cathode of the diode to the positive end of the power supply and the anode of the diode to the negative end of the power supply to prevent each power supply from back charging or producing a reverse polarity across the other power supply. Because if the same effect is occurring with Joe that occurred with Mel, Mel was saying that the glow in the mercury vapor rectifiers went out when he connected these power supplies together. Perhaps that's an indication that the diodes are becoming reverse biased and no longer conducting because each power supply was seeing a reverse polarity from the other power supplies that are connected in series with that. And if that's the case, then I think that could be solved by placing a diode across each power supply so that if there a reverse polarity attempts to be across one of those power supplies, the diode would shun it and prevent it from back charging into that power supply and preventing the diodes from rectifying. Just a crazy thought. K2RAW in the TechNet from KD2BD.
You guys already have those type of diodes put on them already.
Yeah, very fine, John. Your signal is nice and strong tonight. Good propagation. We've had some noisy signals from you in past weeks. In order for that diode that you want to add to his power supplies to become effective, his filter networks on each individual power supply would have to have a ridiculous amount of AC voltage on them. Very unlikely. So I don't think that's going to do it. And as he said, there's already those diodes there. They're already protected in that manner from reverse polarity. Now, that doesn't explain it. And I'm still mystified by Mel's 866 rectifiers that went out. About the only way they can go out and still have filament voltage on them is that there's no current flowing through them or no voltage being supplied to them. So there's quite a mystery going on there in Mel's situation. Mel was really creating high voltage AC by putting the 3 secondary windings of the transformers in series, hopefully properly wired. But with his lack of a volt ohm milliammeter, and he had a makeshift one, there's ways he could have been fooled. The capacitive coupling of the windings could have made it look like they were co-phase, but maybe they were not. Because under those conditions, about the only way that the 866s could go out is they weren't getting any voltage anymore. So there was something crazy about the windings of that secondary. And he didn't really have, as I hear it, a 2,000 volt AC voltmeter that he could put across the composite winding of the secondaries of the transformers under load. That would have been an interesting experiment. I wonder if Mel, did you keep that power supply? You're a guy who tends to keep things. Is that tucked away in your basement somewhere where you can resurrect that particular power supply? K2KEY, K2RIW?
Well, you want to laugh? I only dumped all this stuff only a few years ago. I had it in another house and had to clean up the basement because what was happening, I had tons of surplus sticks, and I mean cartloads of surplus. Did you ever smell a piece of surplus equipment, over?
Oh, yeah. I've spent quite a bit of time in Cortland and Canal Street and all of those other Ryerson, not Ryerson, Cortland Canal. Can't even think of the names of the streets, but they had all of that surplus equipment that you and I used to rummage through in the middle 50s and early 60s before that all got torn down for the World Trade Center. So I've owned quite a few pieces of test equipment, and the smell of the cosmoline or whatever the name of that, the grease they put on things to stop them from rusting and the crazy ways they package them. So I think you're saying you had a basement full of this stuff that was giving off pretty strong surplus equipment smells. Is that what you're saying, Mel? Go ahead.
Got to remember, see, I have another house. I lived there one time, so it was another story. And I had the basement loaded. I mean, loaded with stuff. My God. It took maybe, should I not exaggerate, but I'll be conservative, 15 trips with the wagon, with the station wagon, to get rid of that. And that's what went. All that stuff, plate modulators, the power supplies, the transformers. On and on and on. And that stuff, after a while, laying in the basement, started to give off more of the smell. You know, they sprayed something, the wiring and everything inside there used to be that anti-mildew protection. They used to put on all that stuff. So it got to the point where the people that were there said, you know, there's a funny smell. You know, it's really getting very obnoxious to the things and all. So it just had to go. And I just said, close your eyes, don't cry, and don't pick, and everything. I just said, listen, I'm finished with that stage. I'm not going back to surplus and anything of that sort. And the only thing I picked out of it, Dick, I bet you don't know what I picked out of all that stuff.
An oscilloscope?
Oh, variable capacitors, something that's very hard to come by. Variables. I had tons of variables. From World War II, all kinds of variables, and inductors. That's the only thing I took out of them. And some of those high-voltage type capacitors, you know, those big flat blocks that, you know, had two screws on and that had screw terminals on it. I took about one carton of that. The rest of the stuff I just walked away from over.
Too bad there wasn't some major club you could donate that stuff to where they had storage space and could bring it to flea markets. I bet you thought about that at the time. But, of course, this complaint occurred from a tenant on a cold February afternoon. You had to move the stuff in a couple of days, and you didn't have any time to make any arrangement. Is it a deal like that, Mel?
Oh, yeah. Listen, I've been privy to a number of places. I've seen laboratories being dumped into the dumpster and all, and, like, you know, dived into the dumpsters and all. But when you have a situation where it all had to go real quick, and I mean had to go real quick. Things were getting a little hot under the collar. So I just, like I said, close your eyes, Mel, take a deep breath, and just do what you have to do. So, yes, I know I've mentioned it to a few people, and they literally were crying. You mean you threw out AM modulation transformers? I said, piles them. And swinging chokes? Piles them. Power transformers? Piles them. And piles of this and piles of that. And, oh, and on switches and things and, you know, anything that was in the surplus. Because at the time, I had a deal. I had a guy I knew very well. His father was in the scrap business, and they were getting this tons of surplus in from the Brooklyn Army Terminal. And he said all they wanted was the metal paneling and the stuff. So we stripped down the parts out of it and just threw back the iron paneling and the chassis and all that junk. We could have the individual components, and boy, I just went at it thick, on and on, tons of it, and wound up with, you would get scared. You literally would get scared, and you'd say, my God, I could have put any of the places on Cortlandt Street to shame over.
That's who we are, Dick, from plutonium. Yeah, maybe so. All right, go ahead, Rich.
Yeah, Dick, do we have time for a question? I just woke up. Wasn't feeling too well today. I have a question. I sent you and Mel some email. I don't know if you got it.
Yes, we got your emails about Fred Astaire, and also I can tell you're quite an enthusiast of the 1938 movie scene and the musicals and so on, and tap dancing. I can tell you're quite an enthusiast of those older times. You were born too late, Rich. Let's finish this subject first. If you had enough time, Mel, if you had a couple of weeks forewarning, there's got to be a group in the metropolitan area that would have loved to collect that material, sort through it, and bring it to flea markets. You didn't have the time. I bet if you had it to do over again, I bet you would have found some group that would be appreciative of getting that material. Is that true?
Let me tell you, it's K2KEY. Let's just bring up to us more up to the present. A couple of years ago, I cleaned out a place that had a lot of stuff, instruments and stuff. It was piled up in this garage. And I had to literally beg members of the club and all to come here and clean it out. We took a truckload. It filled up. One guy had a SUV, one of the big ones, a Range Rover. We filled that thing up to the brim. I finally said, please, take it all away out of this garage. We'll raise some money for the club. I had to literally beg for them to take it away. And I said, don't bring anything back. We wound up at Lymark in a backyard there, literally grabbing people by the collar and say, how much money you got? Anything come out of your pocket? Oh, $2 came out of your pocket. Here, take this chassis. That's what we had to do, Dick. And I had stuff left over that finally went out only a few months ago, finally the last of it. I had to beg to get rid of it, over.
That would suggest that very few hams are building anything these days. The VHF, UHF guys, they're still building things. But I think you're telling me the HF guys, they'll build antennas, but very little else are they building. They don't need chassis. They don't need transformers. They don't need power supplies. They don't need chokes. They're not really using that kind of material anymore. Is that sort of what you're saying, Mel?
This, you can't sell or get rid of any of that stuff with all the old tube technology, especially. I had instruments there. We just got rid of maybe a last dozen instruments. This one guy took to Lymark at the last one, the last Lymark deal, I think it was with the one. Yeah, last Lymark, I think he took it. And the previous took the Lymark in the backyard there, all these instruments, generators and scopes and things. I said to the guys in the club, some of them, I finally cajoled them. I said, they got nice oscilloscopes here. Don't you like them to try and see what patterns you can make on a scope, you know, waveform? I was begging them to take stuff away, Dick. That's the only thing I can describe it over.
I have a question. Go ahead, Alex.
Hey, Mel, you wouldn't have a power supply for my laser head, 7,000 volts at 4 amperes?
Light now, Alex. I had power transformers in there that were one of the systems that we stripped down. I remember breaking this thing up because I still got one of the transformers and I'm using it for something else. It's one of the filament transformers, which is only a low voltage, very low voltage, but very high current. I use it for something else. But the power transformers that came out of those RITI, these were 10,000 watt RITI transmitters that used four tubes called the 304TLs. Used four of them. These power transformers in there were rated at about, I think, 8,000 volts at about 2-3 amps. They were big transformers. I had a number of them that I dumped from those. That was those RITI transmitters that I tore apart over.
Yeah, I'm looking for the whole power supply because those power levels, the capacitors are really important. 7,000 volts at 4 or 6 amperes, something like that. All right, I thought you might have something like that. That laser head will stay in my attic for a little while longer.
That's a little late. Like I say, everything is gone. I have nothing now other than more or less modernized. I got rid of 99% of anything I had to do with tube technology. The only thing I have is parts around now for my few Collins rigs and things of that sort, but surplus-wise, all those humongous pieces that, and I mean surplus, you couldn't have picked that transformer up yourself, Alex. That would have taken two hefty guys to move some of that stuff, so it's a shame, but all of it all went to the scrapyard, to the garbage heap, literally. Back to you, Dick.
Boy, his laser head is 28 or 30 kilowatts of raw input. Wow, that's a lethal machine. Hey, Doug, WA2SAY, you're going into the Selden machine, 147375. Glad to hear that you found an antenna that makes that, because I think on the email I had from you, you didn't think you were going to be able to. That particular rig you're using now on 2 meters, maybe you haven't used it for a while, and that particular microphone is giving you very little audio. Nice clean RF, nice clean audio, but very little audio, so it almost sounds like you're talking into the back of the mic, if you know what I mean. But what are you using for an antenna to get into the Selden machine, Doug? WA2SAY with a nice long delay, K2RIW.
Hey, Dick. What I have is a quarter wave antenna on top of the a piece of steel off the side of a PC, and it's up about 6 feet off the floor on my house here, which would make it about maybe 12 feet off the ground. I guess the floor is about 6 feet off the ground. And I will try to get something better on the air. Now, why? I don't know. I understand why the audio is loud. Because this rig always works well. The 10 is 700A. I do it for many years. Screen time here. I put it through an amplifier. It's not through an amplifier now. I could put it through an amplifier, but that's not going to make the audio any wider. So anyway, maybe it needs to be adjusted. I'm not sure how to adjust it because I don't have a device to do that. I can put it on my spectrum analyzer. I guess I have one. Well, I'm not sure how I would adjust it anyway. Let's see. I am so glad to hear that the Zeldin repeater is now being repeated from the Queen's repeater. That's where it should have been for years and years and years. We drop it. Okay, here we are. And I did know that I could get into the Zeldin repeater, but I didn't know it was not repeating the Queen's repeater. And perhaps it only does so during the segment, I'm not sure. Back to you, Dick.
Very fine, Mel. I mean, Doug. The TS-700A, I own two of those. And I think it's a dynamic microphone in there. So it shouldn't have failed, although it could have been dropped or whatever. I think it's a 1970 rig. An oldie but a goodie, maybe a 1975. As I said, I own two of them. I think one of them is operational. One of them's got a intermittent air variable capacitor on the VFO. Sounds like you're getting in there very nicely, and glad to hear you're back on the air after all these years of being away. I think I did mention to you in an email that if you get into the Zeldin machine, you'll be able to get into the TechNet. And Eric KE2EJ and Andy WA2CDL, who are the technical mavens of this group, have tied these two repeaters together for approximately the last 6 months. And most of the day, on most days, they are tied together unless there is an internet failure or a computer failure. They needed an uninterruptible power supply and one of the computers at one of the sites that does the internet connection between the two. It's not an RF link between the two. It's an internet connection. That's why some extra delay has to be added into us dropping before we can pick up people from either Echo Link or the internet. Back to you, Doug, for any further comments on all of the above. And by the way, you must have another 2-meter rig somewhere in the house, a handy talkie or any other 2-meter rig, where you could listen to the audio coming out of your TS-700 versus listening to any other repeater and make the audios approximately the same. That'll get you into the ballpark. You are 15 decibels low right now, Doug. Thank goodness you've got nice, clean audio, nice, clean RF. W-A-2-S-A-Y, K-2-R-I-W in the group.
M-2-R-Q.
Just I'm going to let it drop. There we go. Okay. Yes, I have other 2-meters here in the house. I do have. And actually, I don't have the under the microphone presently available. I don't know where it is. I'm using a Johnson, E.F. Johnson microphone. It happens to plug perfectly into the mic check. And years ago, I thought I got better recording. What else? Anyway, I guess I'm getting out well enough. Radio, something like that. I can see no antenna, so it's working. Yeah, but the license is one for a tabletop radio. Nice. It plays everything, you know, a reasonable number of displays or whatever. You can see what's going on in the modern radio tool for your buttons. But I'm very happy to find out that at least sometimes you sell the repeater. You said the Linditress repeater when you sent me the email. And of course, Linditress is way the heck west of Selden. So I'm probably, let me see, 7 or 8 miles from Selden. Something like that, I would guess. I don't know how to play it. I know my way around. I only been here 6 years. What am I doing? 6 years. And I still don't know where I am. But the building is pretty close. So anyway, back to you, Dick.
Lou, recognize. Pick you up in a second. You go back over that email I just did. I definitely told you Selden Machine 147.375. I'm rather sure I did not say Lindenhurst. I don't know the frequency of the Lindenhurst machine, and I don't know how to spell Lindenhurst. I'd have to look it up. So you go back over that email, you'll find out I did say Selden and 147.375. Lou, what would you like to add to all this? N2RQ, K2RIW.
And I got a question, Dick, if that's okay.
I'd like to finish my comment from before also.
I have one thing to add, and that is the IRLT reflector that both of these repeaters are linked through is 9126 New England reflector. And I took a look earlier, and there were two other nodes connected at the time, one near Las Vegas, the other one, I think, in California. So we drag our feet a little bit. We may get some joiners from out the west. The other thing I had, because I missed something earlier from Mel, I'm curious if he remembers the name of the teacher at Brooklyn Tech that he was referring to. And then I have a sort of an announcement or request for people in general on the net. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, Joe, we're going to pick up your final comment because we didn't really finish yours. But, Mel, you did mention the name of the teacher you went to with the power supply, and apparently Lou wants to know who it is, K2KEY, K2RIW.
Mr. Rose, R-O-S-E.
Do you remember him, Lou?
Negative. It's before my time. And, or at least he's gone since before my time. But it's always interesting. We'll be listening. I know you want to pick up a couple of things there, but I have one other which I can wait for.
Yeah, according to your QRZ, you're only 5 years younger than Mel and I. I'm amazed that teacher wasn't there. Go ahead with your announcement with reference to the TechNet. Sounds like that should be a point of order for one of the directors of the club. Go ahead, Mel. Here we go. Lou?
Well, it's really incidental. Since Mel got my ears perked up when he mentioned Brooklyn Tech, yesterday was the 85th anniversary homecoming. And it was the 25th annual homecoming. And just coincidentally with that, we have the radio club at Brooklyn Tech, which right now has no home. And concurrently with that, there is an inactive attempted to re-stimulate club at Stuyvesant High School. And we're not looking for equipment or donations or anything like that. I'm looking for support that we might be able to put some pressure on the current administration. If anyone is interested, please contact me at N2RQ at ARRL.net, and we'll see if we can stimulate something. That, that's really about it. There's interest in different directions, but so far no movement, Dick. This is N2RQ.
Sounds like it's going to take a labor of love dedication by some particular ham radio group to give support to either Stuyvesant High School or Brooklyn Tech. What do you think it's going to require to provide the support that you think is needed, Lou? Go ahead.
I'm not sure. At Stuyvesant, I think getting some people to show local interest would help. At Tech, I'm there, and the kids keep coming. We just don't have a space right now. We lost equipment. We have replacement equipment. We just don't have a place to put it. At Stuyvesant, we got an email this past week from an interested alumnus out in California who is offering to donate a very nice HF rig and wants to know what else can be done. And we're trying to see if we can drum up some interest at the place, a demonstration station or something where the kids can get reacquainted with it. The call sign at Stuyvesant is W2CLE, which I think can be traced back to 1909. And at Tech, it's W2CXN, which can be traced back to 1921. So a little bit of history and a little bit of rivalry between the two schools, too. Back to you, Dick, and to RQ.
Very fine. So to repeat what Lou just told us, if you would like to contribute to his effort, please get a hold of Lou at n2rq@arrl.net. Joe, you've got your homework assignment to make a couple of measurements to try to resolve your mystery. You've got an interesting power supply mystery, and I think you said you had some closing comments. So V2RYY, K2RIW.
Yes, I have a closing comment about a subject we talked about two, maybe 3 weeks ago when I was testing my station master antenna, and I had the thing mounted on a fence, and I said when it rained, all of a sudden I had like the descent wall come up tremendously. Remember how that whole test set up, how I described it, putting a weak signal in, running about 100 watts of power, and testing it that way? Yes, the fence is rusty. I tested it on a dry day, and the problem went away. I also took a garden hose and wet the fence down about 25 feet each direction from the antenna, and the fence did not contribute at all to the problem. One thing I did find which contributed to the problem was my garage door about 30 feet away. When I opened the garage door inadvertently, doing something else, I had this test running, and I had the HD with me. I heard it, and when I went up, the cabling of the garage door caused a tremendous amount of RF static. So the initial problem wasn't coming from the fence. Don't know wherever it came from, even though it doesn't really matter because the antenna got to take it off and put on the building anyway. It was just a test. But just to let you know about that sometimes the problem is not always what you think it is.
Okay, you've got a pretty strong piece of evidence for what you feel it could be. Bear in mind that when rain occurs and dew occurs in the morning, it's fairly different than what you can create with a hose. I have often seen on the tips of my 432 Yagi elements great big droplets of water that you get with dew in the morning that will detune the antenna. You try to do that with a fine spray from a hose and you can't do it. So Mother Nature has got different ways of putting water on metallic objects. And my speculation was it's a chain link fence aggravating your problem. There could be other things in the environment, but the bottom line is that we're discovering that anything within, let me pick a number, 20 feet of a repeater antenna has to have extremely high RF integrity. No rusty bolt effects of any kind if you don't want to get some peculiar crackly noises and descent noises into a repeater. An antenna that is transmitting and receiving simultaneously has to really be in a pristine environment if you want full performance. It is for that reason that many cell sites insist on not transmitting and receiving from the same antenna simultaneously. So use one set of antennas for transmitting, another set of antennas for receiving, if at all possible. Because a full duplex on the same equipment
puts an extremely high performance requirement on intermodulation distortion, like minus 150 dBc components of a two-tone test at 20 watts each. Very severe test. It takes exotic equipment that I've worked on at one time to try to make that measurement. Very exotic equipment. Let's see now. Before we get into what Rich into EO wants to open up, tell me what kind of mail and what kind of flack we're getting on that mail, Mel. Should we handle at least one piece of mail to try to keep those people happy? K2KEY, K2LIW.
Thanks, this is K2KEY. Just to answer the question about Mr. Rhodes, he retired 1959. He was going one more turn. I graduated 58, and he retired subsequently with the next term. I remember him telling me that he was just about ready to retire. So anybody that came after 59 surely would not have met him. All right, let's see. Yeah, I have a number of them here. questions that, okay, different products, things like that, but I have here one antenna question that may be of interest to a lot of people, Dick, over.
Okay, and when I pass it back to you, give a nice long delay in case anyone else on the internet wants to check in. K2KEY with some delay, K2LIW.
Okay, doesn't sound like anybody else wants to join us. All right, this person asks a very interesting question. He says, because of my situation where I live, I operate mostly HF mobile. However, there are times that I'd like to put out on my little patio deck an antenna for just temporary operation. If I got myself another mobile antenna, exactly the one I'm using, and put them back-to-back in like a dipole configuration, can I make a workable dipole for a number of the bands similar to what I use in the mobile? In other words, these is the mobile, these, you know, mobile antennas with the taps for a number of different HF bands, and he wants to, in other words, get another one and make himself some kind of a sort of a, you know, a dipole effect that he can more or less snap together some way with and feed it. What is the practicality on that, Dick? Over.
Interesting. Any piece of metal can be made into an antenna. Can you do this? Absolutely. Is it the best way to go? Is an interesting question. See, in the case of a mobile, you've got an extremely severe environment. You've got extremely little real estate to work with. The only counterpoise you've got, the ground plane, so to speak, is the metal frame of the car. And you've got to put some kind of a whip-like antenna that hits some kind of resonance in that environment. So a screwdriver-like antenna, tunable antenna, or antenna with taps, coils and taps and whatever, on that whip for a mobile installation, is designed that way because of the constraints of that particular environment. To force all of those constraints into the environment of an antenna you put into your home, you can do it. It'll work. But it's a tough way to go. There are so many nicer ways to go. In the case of a house, you've got a lot more real estate to work with than you do with a car. There's all kinds of dipoles you can string under the rug, across the wall, across the ceiling, in the attic, above the roof of the house, dipoles in the backyard and whatever. Any antenna that's in free space, away from the house, at roughly tree height, is going to give you a tremendously more performance compared to any kind of an antenna you put on your back porch in your house, so to speak. Any antenna you put buried within your house, if you're forced to do that because your landlord won't do you anything else, and hopefully you live on the 13th floor of an apartment building, let me drop.